but I am aware of the risk that I'm taking by traveling during this time of year.
Omicron causes travel chaos. It's Tuesday, December 28th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Chris Cascale in Washington. Find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, promoting closer Taiwan ties, unvaccinated healthcare costs, anti-apartheid activist Tutu's legacy, Chinese in Canada's smallest province, high-tech restaurant service. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Surging coronavirus cases across the world are threatening healthcare systems in countries seeing a significant spread. The newest variant, Omicron, led to thousands of flight cancellations ahead of the Christmas holiday. U.S. President Joe Biden last week announced plans to send 1,000 service members to support U.S. hospital staff and plans to stockpile masks and gowns. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
More than 700 inbound, outbound, and domestic commercial flights in the United States are canceled. Sunday's news comes after airlines say they grounded thousands of flights leading up to Christmas, with reports of pilots and staff falling ill amid the surging Omicron variant of the coronavirus. But at some airports, like the one in Newark, New Jersey, it's business as usual. Sheldon Williams from Ottawa, Canada, is visiting New York, and he tells AP his trip is not one of leisure.
I came here for a funeral, and because of the importance of the person it was, that's why I decided to travel. But I do know the risk that I'm taking, you know, flying and whatnot. But, you know, sometimes it's not about you. It's about certain things that are more important to you in life. So that's why I decided to travel, essentially. But I am aware of the risk that I'm taking by traveling during this time of year.
Health experts warn that anyone in an airport will likely come in contact with the Omicron variant. But recent reports from South Africa and England point to promising data showing surging Omicron infections as being less likely to lead to hospitalization or severe illness. Sunday on ABC's This Week, President Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said that does not signal the all clear.
When you have such a high volume of new infections, it might override a real diminution in severity. So that if you have many, many, many more people with a less level of severity, that might kind of neutralize the positive effect.
Fauci praised the president's multifaceted plan to have military personnel in support roles at U.S. hospitals to help deal with surging cases, along with ramped up testing and stockpiling personal protective equipment. Still, he says, vaccination remains the single best way to prevent disease.
We're particularly worried about those who are in that unvaccinated class, that, you know, tens and tens of millions of Americans who are eligible for vaccination who have not been vaccinated. Those are the most vulnerable ones when you have a virus that is extraordinarily effective in getting to people and infecting them the way Omicron is.
Despite the looming threat of Omicron and all the canceled flights, the Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport was packed with holiday travelers last Friday, Christmas Eve. Reuters spoke with a few of them.
Great, except for waiting for your bags a little longer than usual. But other than that, the flight was great, on time, so pretty good.
It was a little stressful, but we made it. We're here.
We had the first flight out this morning, so we thought we'd be okay. Worked out well.
Omicron now accounts for nearly three-quarters of all U.S. cases. According to news reports, the average number of new infections is about 165,000 per day. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Read more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Myanmar court delays verdict in Aung San Suu Kyi trial. China talks up Green Olympics but prepares to fight Smog. UN horrified by reports of massacre of civilians in Myanmar. Pakistan slams Taliban curbs on Afghan women. Taliban further restrict Afghan women with new travel rules. Get complete coverage on these headlines, plus more stories on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the VOAnews.com website. Thank you for joining us on VOA Asia on this Tuesday. This year, U.S. Republicans and Democrats have made a point of publicly embracing Taiwan with a flurry of congressional visits and an invitation to the Democracy Summit hosted by U.S. President Joe Biden. VOA's Nike Ching reports on how officials are promoting closer U.S.-Taiwan ties without fundamentally changing Washington's overall One China policy.
Republican and Democratic senators visiting Taiwan in June, just one of the trips by lawmakers signaling support for a self-ruled democracy. Since that visit, the U.S. and Taiwan have held more trade and investment talks. Taiwan already is one of America's top 10 largest trading partners, and officials are seeking even closer economic ties.
We discussed the number of items that are important to both the U.S. and to Taiwan, supply chain issues, economic coercion, science and technology exchanges, things that we can do to try and deepen our people-to-people relations as well as to deepen our economic partnership.
Taiwan is home to the world's largest contract chipmaker, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC. Many link the survival of Taiwan's democracy to U.S. supply chain security.
Taiwan has a free and open market. It's got a democratic political system. It's a very good business climate. And so in that sense, having a free and democratic Taiwan is critically important for the U.S. economically, and it's important more broadly for U.S. supply chain security as well.
After a virtual meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping, the Biden administration invited Taiwan to participate in the Summit for Democracy, drawing a sharp rejection from China.
What the U.S. did proves that its so-called democracy is just a pretext and a tool for it to pursue its geopolitical goals, suppress other countries, divide the world, serve its own interests, and maintain its hegemony in the world.
Beijing claims sovereignty over Taiwan. Taipei considers the island a sovereign state. So far, analysts say the Biden administration's positions mirror long-standing U.S. policy.
The U.S. can recognize Taiwan as a democracy, but at the same time, it can uphold the One China policy. The Biden administration, as well as the Trump administration before it, have emphasized not only the three communiques, which are about, you know, One China and also the U.S.'s position on Taiwan, but also the Taiwan Relations Act and the Six Assurances.
In the face of continuing threats from China, Taiwan has increased its defense capabilities. The U.S. is also continuing arms sales to Taiwan under the Taiwan Relations Act. After switching diplomatic recognition from Taiwan to China in 1979, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the U.S. is taking every action of both deterrence and diplomacy to make sure the scenario that China uses force to unify Taiwan never happens. Nike Ching, VOA News, at the State Department.
The Nicaraguan government has seized the former embassy and diplomatic offices of Taiwan, saying they belong to China. The government of President Daniel Ortega broke ties with Taiwan this month and recognized China. Before departing, Taiwanese diplomats attempted to donate the properties to the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Managua. But Ortega's government said Sunday any such donation would be invalid and that the building in an upscale Managua neighborhood belongs to China. The Attorney General's office called the attempted donation a subterfuge. Taiwan denounced the takeover of the properties, calling it gravely illegal. Still to come on VOA Asia, Australia debates higher healthcare costs for the unvaccinated. Happening now in Asia, the Chinese city of Xi'an, where 13 million residents are currently confined to their homes, announced tightened restrictions on Sunday as the country recorded 206 new coronavirus infections, the most since March 2020. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. A suggestion by Australia's most populous state to charge unvaccinated people for COVID-19 medical costs has received widespread criticism. The New South Wales proposal has angered doctors and some federal politicians who argue that healthcare in Australia is free and universal. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The New South Wales government has said that unvaccinated patients being treated for COVID-19 have been irresponsible and have burdened taxpayers with very substantial costs, and they could be forced to pay for their hospital care. State Transport Minister David Elliott.
There already is two classes of hospital system, because you've got the unvaccinated that are there because they haven't been taking responsibility for their actions, and you've got the vaccinated there who have got a genuine requirement for healthcare.
But members of Australia's federal government have been sceptical about making unvaccinated COVID-19 patients pay for their treatment. The Australian Medical Association said the proposal was unethical, and it doubted that it was even legal. The president of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, Dr. Karen Price, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that it would affect disadvantaged communities.
We might make all sorts of judgments on people who smoke or have an unhealthy lifestyle, and the unvaccinated would be a large cohort of those people might have low health literacy. And we know in some of our Indigenous communities where vaccination rates are low, this would be an unethical procedure to implement.
90% of eligible Australians are fully vaccinated. On Thursday, New South Wales recorded 5,715 COVID-19 cases, a new daily record for any Australian jurisdiction during the pandemic. A negative result is required for travel between various states and territories. Western Australia has become the first jurisdiction to introduce mandatory COVID-19 booster shots for certain sections of its population. It's also reintroducing internal border controls with Tasmania and the Northern Territory to try to curb the spread of the Omicron variant. Entry into Western Australia from other parts of the country will be prohibited without an exemption. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. Victims of the worst flooding to hit Malaysia in years start the long process of fixing up damaged homes and cleaning the streets as they mourn lost loved ones. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Welcome back to VOA Asia. South Africa has started a week of mourning for Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu, who died Sunday at the age of 90. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
The bells of St. George's Cathedral rang out for 10 minutes on Monday. It was here that Archbishop Tutu gave refuge to many during the dark days of apartheid. His non-violent campaign won him international recognition, including the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984. He was also greatly loved by his countrymen and women. Veteran journalist Aisha Ismail explains.
You know, as a South African and as a journalist, when I think about Archbishop Desmond Tutu, I think about love, I think about justice, I think about peace, and I think about compassion. Archbishop Desmond Tutu was the one who opened the doors of this cathedral when we were fighting the apartheid regime. during the height of apartheid and during the state of emergency, we were tear gassed, we were shamblocked, and it was the Archbishop who opened these doors for us to come and seek refuge. He will be deeply missed, and I think I can safely say that South Africa has lost its moral compass.
Once democracy was established in South Africa in 1994, Tutu continued to campaign for human rights, championing all kinds of causes around the world. In recent years, he also spoke out against the African National Congress, which is in power in South Africa. He was outraged by the unchecked corruption within the party. Children and young people were close to his heart. He was a patron of many trusts. The CEO of one of them, Jason Falcon, says even when Tutu was ill, the Archbishop was in email contact with him so they could work out a plan to ensure funding came in after he passed on.
Not only for the trust, but also for our beneficiaries, the children of Tigerberg Hospital, has been immense. You know, the arch and my layer, the many visits to the hospital was always filled with joy and laughing. The kids really looked out for that. But over and above that, the arch was also very instrumental, especially in the early years of the trust, in raising significant funds, specifically for the purchase of much-needed medical equipment, which ranged into the hundreds of thousands of rands.
The assistant priest at St. George's Cathedral, Marcus Slingers, says it was a great privilege to have visited Tutu at his home in Milnerton, a Cape Town suburb, for about 40 minutes each day.
We are all saddened by this great loss. The Dean and I and others, you know, in this last few months, had the opportunity of celebrating the Eucharist with him every day. And that was part of his life. And I've just been privileged, you know, to have been part of it. And what a man of God and humble.
The Archbishop's 66-year marriage to Leah Tutu was admired by many. They had four children, Trevor, Tandeka, Naomi and Mpo. Father Marcus says on his visits to Tutu, Mrs. Tutu would tell him stories over cups of tea about how they supported each other.
And how the two of them had just done, you know, things together. Everything that they've done together. And our hearts and our prayers, our thoughts are with her and the rest of the family.
A number of events are planned for this week, including a memorial service which the South African Council of Churches will host on Wednesday. Archbishop Tutu's body will lie in state at St. George's Cathedral on Friday. His funeral will take place there on Saturday. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town.
Making headlines in Asia, local monitoring groups say a handful of Myanmar nurses hiding from the junta have been running makeshift clinics to treat COVID-19 patients and resistance fighters with medicine smuggled past military checkpoints. Stay up to date with VOA or listening to VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. The smallest province in Canada has received the largest percentage of population growth in the country in 2021. Prince Edward Island, in eastern Canada, has been trying to attract immigrants for years, including people from China. Ken Linton reports for VOA from the island in the Atlantic.
Emily Pei moved to Canada 12 years ago. Her journey from southern China to Canada was a decision made out of love.
My husband, he's a Canadian. He went to teach in China, and that's where we met.
Pei's husband wanted to return to Canada, took her to Prince Edward Island for a summer visit, and the rest is history.
I just fell in love with PEI, so I said, okay, sure, we can.
Pei says there are several ways immigrants arrive on the island.
You know, you have mainly two pathways to come here. One is through your skills, the other is through business. Depends. What kind of skill set you have.
Today, this former university instructor helps foreigners, including some from China, make a new home in Prince Edward Island with her company called Canada Ask. Pei says the reason why someone from China would resettle on Prince Edward Island.
Most of them, you know, they can say for the education for my children.
Canada has been experiencing a labor shortage since before the pandemic. Immigration is one solution. From 2020 to 2021, even with the pandemic, 4% of new immigrants who are working or will soon arrive to work on the island are from China. Jeff Young, director at Prince Edward Island's Immigration Office, estimates more than 2,000 people from China currently live on the island. He says they are here for different reasons.
They enjoy the, you know, the fresh air, those sorts of things, the peace, the quiet, the tranquility. But the big reason they give us is for their kids. They want to come to Canada and come to PEI to build a better life for their children. It's a safe place. It's the work-life balance. There's activities for their kids to do. We do have a good educational system, which they appreciate for their kids.
Overall, not all of the island residents stay. Some move to other parts of Canada. It's Canada's smallest province with just over 164,000 people. There are some limitations, including fewer private schools and a limited number of family doctors. Pei is one who stayed to raise her family and has witnessed positive changes for the local Chinese community.
I think compared with, you know, things 10 years ago, it's much better now with the Chinese supermarket, you know. We have, before I think only one or two, but now maybe more than five, six now. So the Chinese community is growing.
With an estimated 1.9% annual growth rate and a working age population on the rise, in part because of immigration, Canada's smallest province is quickly transforming and becoming more diverse each year. Ken Linton for VOA News, Prince Edward Island, Canada.
Finally on VOA Asia, a restaurant in Mosul, Iraq, isn't known for its comfortable atmosphere or its great food and drinks. It's known for its servers. VOA's Kawa Omar filed this report, narrated by Rikar Hussein.
This restaurant in Mosul, Iraq, serves food in an unusual way. Hundreds of people visit the restaurant each week to watch robots deliver Iraqi food from the kitchen to the tables.
It's a great experience. We hope that God will make it a successful experience, and we hope better for Mosul. Mosul needs things like this from good people, now that we have some security and are safe from the Islamic State terrorist group.
Mosul, Iraq's second largest city, was ravaged by the Islamic State group from 2014 to 2017. Locals regard the restaurant, which was built by a group of Mosul University students, as a symbol of life returning to the city.
As students and graduates of the engineering department of Mosul University, we thought about entering the private sector because there's no government employment anymore. We thought about doing something unique. There are plenty of restaurants and cafeterias, and we had to come up with a different idea. This is how we came up with the robots.
This restaurant may not be the first to employ robot servers. It is, however, the first of its kind in Iraq.
We are providing unique services here. First, there are the robots. Second, there are interactive tables that allow customers to order food, play games, and connect to the internet. This enables them to have a fun time while they wait for food.
The restaurant's founders say the concept is a big hit so far. The restaurant is attracting food lovers from all over Iraq who come for the robots but stay for the food. For Kawa Omar in Mosul, Iraq, Rikar Hussein, VOA News.
Read and see more on this story at VOA Asia Facebook. That's all the time we have for today's VOA Asia. Make sure you find us on all our social media platforms. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. You can also find us on Instagram, YouTube, and at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, and Jessica Stone. I'm Chris Cascao in Washington. Enjoy the day, stay safe, and be well.